Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is your host, Morteza Hajizadeh from Critical Theory Channel, New Books Network. Today, I'm honored to be speaking with Professor Alan Bullard. Professor Alan Bullard is a professor of economics at Victoria University of Wellington, New Zealand. He formerly managed APEC, the largest regional economic integration organization in the world, and was previously the New Zealand Reserve Bank governor. He recently published a book with Oxford University Press called Economics at War, How a Handful of Economists Help Win and Lose World Wars. Alan, welcome to New Books Network.
Yes, thank you, Morteza.
Can you please just very briefly introduce yourself, your field of expertise, and tell us why you decided to write this book, Economics at War?
Sure. Well, you know, I've had a long history as a sort of senior civil servant in New Zealand and elsewhere. And that's all been involved with understanding economics, in particular policy situations where you're trying to work to improve economies or improve livelihoods of people by using economics in a good way. I've always enjoyed writing, and actually I've always also enjoyed reading biographies, particularly biographies of economists that put the sort of intellectual thinking in a real world and background environment. And so this was a piece of work that I was keen to do, really after reading around some of these particular economists. This had all set during the lead into World War II and the aftermath as well. And it's a situation like that when economics really poses some difficult problems. I was the central bank governor in New Zealand during the global financial crisis, learned something about sort of crisis management and how things are coming at you and you need to respond, but you don't necessarily have a very clear idea at all about just what that all means. And so the World War II period is that sort of situation writ much larger, where these economists were in an interesting position to do things. The ones I've picked out all did. I've selected seven economists to profile in this. They're all interconnected in a way, but they're all from quite different countries in quite different positions. And they all made a difference one way or the other, but they weren't all good people, and they weren't necessarily even all good economists.
You kind of actually answered my next question, which is great. And I must confess that when I came across the book, I read the title, I first thought that it's more about those new liberal economies in the 1970s, but was quite fascinated by the range of economies you've chosen and also their stories and how interrelated these stories are. So let's talk about Japan. That's the first country you discuss in your book. And the person you discuss is... if I'm pronouncing the name correctly, Takahashi Kurikyo, I'll leave it to you to correct me. Can you tell us about Takahashi, who he was, what position he held, and also how he managed to help the country through its financial crisis during the Great Depression?
Yeah, sure. Well, I start off with Japan, as you say, and indeed I was quite keen to sort of correct a bit of European bias and imbalance in a lot of the commentary about World War II. It wasn't just a European war. It wasn't simply won by the British or the Americans. The big conflicts were Germany, Soviet Union, and Japan, China. So for that reason, I do start off in Japan with Takahashi Kokyu. He's a fascinating character. He's brought up in a rough sort of way in Tokyo, really, before the turn of the century, and has a pretty rough upbringing with gangs in Tokyo, but actually has a lot of natural talent, becomes a great linguist. He works in unusual places. He manages to build up very interesting relationships, and he sort of builds up a career through the early Japan civil service around the turn of the century from a very unlikely upbringing. And he makes his name raising funds in the European market for the Japanese-Russian War of 1904-1905. But after that, he has roles in the Ministry of Finance and in the Bank of Japan, eventually becomes governor of the Bank of Japan, and also has an amazing record of 7 times Minister of Finance in Japan. And in those roles, he basically carries out very innovative fiscal and monetary and exchange rate policies of a sort that, in a sense, Keynes later writes about in his general theory, but this is all before then. So actually in the 1920s, late 20s, early 30s, when the global depression is just starting to hit Japan, Takahashi-san carries out some very interesting exchange rate policies, monetary policies of a sort that we would now call quantitative easing, and fiscal stimulus. And actually, Ben Bernanke later on called him really Japan's Keynes. And he did that. He had read some of Keynes' material. He had learned from a lot of others, but he had no initial formal economics training. But in doing that, he kept Japan out of the depression and allowed them to have growth through the period. But I'm also interested in the fact that as Minister of Finance, he's there trying to put in place sensible fiscal policies to allow disciplined spending and to stop the runaway militarism and military spending that's going on at the time. The Japanese military had become very strong during the 1930s. They were pushing through budgets that couldn't be properly funded and were going to lead to big rearmaments in Japan and ultimately to World War II. Takahashi did his best to put those in a disciplined sort of basis. And what happened in 1936, a group of radical army officers broke into his house one night and slaughtered him. So he was assassinated for trying to carry out really good economic policy. And really, that was the beginning of the end for Japanese democracy. After that, they slid into militarism, big spending, and within a year or two, invading China and then later most of Southeast Asia.
I think it's a perfect segue into my next question. This assassination that you mentioned, what was the next country you mentioned is China. So what was the consequence of his assassination and the subsequent war in China? How is it related?
Well, Japan had been chiseling away at China for quite a long time. Japan is a country that had a growing industrial base, but very little in the way of raw materials. So they needed iron ore, they needed coal, they needed energy, and they needed foodstuffs, and they were doing that by extending their influence into Manchuria, Formosa, Korea. And in 1937, the rearmed Japanese economy, the military invaded coastal areas of China, and it became a huge conflict with terrible conduct and terrible fatalities as well. China had broken away from the old Song dynasty. Sun Yat-sen had become the first president of a sort of new republic of China. And by this time, Chiang Kai-shek was the Republican president, but he didn't control China. China was in a turbulent state with the Kuomintang controlling some areas, the Chinese Communist Party, some of the inland areas, warlords controlling other parts of China, and gangs running some of the local economies in some of the big cities like Shanghai. Chiang Kai-shek appointed H.H. Kung, his brother-in-law, to be Minister of Finance and later Central Bank Governor. Kung was part of the famous Song Sister Dynasty. Kung's wife, Eileen, was the richest woman in China. Kung's sister-in-law, Chung Ling, was or had been married to Sun Yat-sen and was something of a Chinese ideological hero. Kung's other sister-in-law, Mei Ling, was married to Chiang Kai-shek. So you can see it was a dynasty, and the brother, T.V. Sung, had also been Minister of Finance and was one of the richest men in China. Kung sort of made it work with Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang Kai-shek needed lots of money to pay for his army, because if he didn't, groups of them would break away and go off to warlords. And Chiang Kai-shek was fighting a war on two fronts, against the Japanese, but particularly also against the Chinese Communist Party. And to make that all work required somebody of H.H. Kung's character. Kung was he was a very corrupt man. He was always able to find a way of making a deal work. And when there was a deal, there was always some money under the table for him and his family as well. So he basically managed to collect a lot of revenue from Chinese peasants and Chinese business people to fund Chiang Kai-shek's military role. And he did that by extortion, by heavyweight policing and army officers, by using the Green Gang in Shanghai to come down like mafia to make businessmen pay up. And these were all very, unhygienic sort of roles, but they were what it required in that completely disrupted period of China in the 1930s. And he ended up, as a consequence, collecting quite an amount of revenue. When the war started, he also became very adept at manipulating the Americans to give China aid to fight the communists. So, and eventually the Japanese as well. And he really held the Americans to ransom the way he managed to make all his arguments about how to do that. And as I said, there was always something for him and his family in it. And as a consequence, he probably became the richest man in China and possibly even for a while the richest man in the world. He was investigated by the security services in the States for his corruption. But whatever happened, the Americans found it very difficult to break the link with him because he was the way they were going to ultimately defeat the communists in China. Ultimately, when the communists took over, Kung and the whole family pretty much left China, went to Taiwan, and some of them went on to the States and made more money there.
And he himself also went to the United States when the communists took over, right?
Absolutely. He was very worried about his own welfare and that of his family and the possibilities of making more money. So he set up banking systems in the States and did very well there.
Let's move to Germany. And you mentioned this character who, again, I'm not sure about the pronunciation of the name, Hallmar Schacht, which, anyway, I'll leave it to you to correct me again. And how did he manage Hitler's finances, or let's say Germany's finances, how to especially the army, without really being sanctioned? And he also knew Kung, am I right?
Yeah, one of the things that Kung did was try and set up barter deals with other suppliers. Basically, China had no foreign reserves. They couldn't afford to buy in armaments that they needed, for example. But he managed to he went to Berlin and met Helmut Schacht and actually Adolf Hitler as well, and did some deals buying in German armaments in return for tungsten and other raw materials out of China. Omar Sharp was an interesting character. Now, he probably was quite a good economist, but I don't think many people would say he was a particularly nice person. He had been the president of the Reichsbank, the central bank in Germany in the early 1920s. And Germany had suffered this terrible hyperinflation, just unbelievable amounts of inflation through that period. And that was that caused such an unsettling living condition that was one reason why a lot of the Germans turned to National Socialism and the Nazis. After becoming something of a hero in Germany in the 1920s as his role at the Reichsbank, he became effectively, Hitler's banker in a sense, raising funds for the now Nazi-dominated government in Berlin that was looking to build up its armaments after the World War One defeats that it suffered. And he had designed and carried out some quite innovative ways of raising funds where the government would issue bonds and businesses could put money into those, knowing that they could be refinanced through the Reichsbank. There was a central bank there through what was called the MIFO bills. And they were they're the sort of things you find in Wall Street today, but at that stage in Europe, you didn't find at all. They were quite innovative. He also worked out a number of bartering trade deals to save foreign exchange, because by the late 1930s, the financial markets were closing up on Germany and the Allies were starting to get very worried about how that country was developing, and they were cutting back trade and not lending into the German economy. And Schatz did a number of deals whereby he managed to save foreign exchange and still get imports into the German system and help them build up their armaments. Schatz was basically quite, at times, close to Hitler, although he never actually joined the Nazis. He is credited as being the only person to ever leave Hitler in tears when he gave him a very long, very turgid argument about good monetary policy. And he was clearly a guy that was very clever in terms of IQ, but not very clever in terms of his relationships. Nobody seemed to like him. He would lecture all sorts of people on all sorts of issues. During the war itself, he continued to raise funds. He tried to get innovative ways to get money from the Jews for the Nazi finances. He insisted he was doing efficient, good processes, but he clearly was a very, very flawed person in terms of the way he did this. Eventually, he got so many enemies, even within the German governmental system, that they arrested him and put him into a concentration camp. Now, Schacht was just outraged at that. And the one thing that sort of kept him alive during the last year of the war was his absolute outrage at the fact that he, a good economist, had been locked up when all he was trying to do was get proper economic advice. It indicates that the guy didn't really sort of have a normal review, a very high self-regard, not a normal view of what was happening and what was going wrong through all that period. After the war, the Americans came in and released him from the concentration camp, but very quickly they realized that he had a key role in rearming Germany, and they locked him up again and put him on trial in the Nuremberg Military Tribunal hearings, where he faced prosecutors who argued that it was only his economic genius that had allowed Germany to rearm itself enough to carry out World War II, and that therefore he should be found guilty of war crimes. There's some very interesting material on the arguments that were made. The Russian and the American judges would clearly like to have hanged him. Schatz himself gave a long and involved and complicated explanation of what he had done, and he nearly made things worse for himself by irritating everybody in the courtroom so much. But in the end, he was let off. He actually then set up his own consultancy and financial bank and gave advice to various other countries. But it was really his wartime role that wrote about in here. And without him, Germany wouldn't have lasted in the field as long as he managed to allow them to.
From all these economists that you talk about, I myself only knew Keynes for very good reasons, because he's quite well known with his Keynesian economy. So let's move to England. Tell us a little about Keynes, and also I'm really interested to know about his general theory to policy, what it was. And I did not know myself that he laid the foundation for International Monetary Fund. So it would be great if we could talk about these things.
Yeah, well, Keynes was a genius, as he kept telling people. And he does pop up everywhere. He's got a very, very full life, so you do hear about him in all sorts of contexts. With regard to, I mean, he'd been around in the UK Treasury during World War One. He had given advice at the Versailles peace settlement, wasn't taken. He wrote a famous book about the economic consequences of the peace and very accurately predicted that the harsh settlement that had been imposed on Germany after World War One would lead to a renewed rise of militarism and more warfare. He was just right about that. During World War II, he wrote a couple of newspaper articles, which later on became published as a small book called How to Pay for the War. And he's giving advice basically saying, well, traditionally in wartime, governments ration all sorts of goods because governments have this big problem about how to move resources from the civilian economy, households want to buy stuff, into the military economy, basically arms and material for keep armies going. And Keynes said, well, it's not, there's a question about who's going to pay for this. And quite often, or previously in warfare, governments had generally borrowed money when they could, but very quickly financial markets close up on them and they end up rationing goods and putting up with inflation. He said, well, there's a range of ways you can do that. Who's going to pay for it? Let's be more transparent about it. And it could be households rationed. It could be consumers who have to pay higher prices with inflation. It could be people who lend money. They could be foreigners through financial markets. They could be domestic. And that all relates to, war's going to have a very big cost. Is that cost going to be paid for by the citizens of the country, by the citizens of countries that will be conquered? And that was what the Germans were trying to do, was various quartering fees, they used to call them, imposed on France and Poland and other countries that they had invaded. And actually, that's what the British did with its colonies like India during the old colonialist days. Or should be paid for by future generations, by the government borrowing. And he put out a whole range of possibilities and said, well, this is going to partly depend on whether you're stimulating the economy or whether you're contracting the economy. And that's often quite a complex sort of thing. And in particular, after the war, the economy is going to be very cash poor and there'll be a loss of assets due to wartime damage. But will there be a very strong demand stimulating the economy, or will it be quite the opposite? Will the economy just be in contractionary phase? And this was an argument that a number of economists had. Now, Keynes knew quite a bit about this because he had written a book on government stimulation, the general theory, in 1935-36, that had a huge impact on governments around the world, really. And that the argument of that was when economies look to be in decline, and you've been talking about the Great Depression, it is possible for a government, through its treasury spending, to just stimulate the economy by spending more on a range of possible things, which will have to be paid for in the future. But that could be desirable if it gets you out of an economic hole and if you can then cut back on spending at a later date. A lot of the people who looked at that were very interested in it. They were thinking of it more as an ongoing feature rather than a transitory feature. One of the things that wartime did was led to huge amounts of government spending right around the world and big increase in government. But Keynes' view was always, well, you're going to have to pay for that in the end. going to have to cut back in the end in all this. Interestingly, he had submitted these two very long articles to the Times newspaper in London, and the Times had accepted them, but took a long time to actually get them into print. And in the meantime, a Swedish journalist had got hold of them, and he published them in Germany in the Frankfurter Daily. So quite bizarrely, the Germans were able to read this advice before the British were, and we assumed that Elmar Schacht would have been very interested to read about all this advice on how to stimulate the wartime economy. Now, as you mentioned, Keynes was at the very core of the Bretton Woods discussions, and he had his own views before Bretton Woods on an international pairing union, which ultimately led to the IMF. So that he, in the next couple of years, spent a lot of time negotiating with the Americans on the IMF, the World Bank, and what would ultimately become the World Trade Organization as well, although that took a little bit longer. And although Keynes really killed himself with the effort that he put into doing this, he had a bad heart attack in 1946 and died. His intellectual contribution was just a key in setting up what we now call the Bretton Woods Conventions, the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, which actually played a huge part in the next 30, 40 years of growth around the world, and is now under a lot of questioning and discussion.
Mm-hmm. Another fascinating economist you talk about in the book is Leonid Kantorovich from Russia, and you talk about how his mathematical genius helped plan Russian economy. Can you tell us a little bit about him? And I'm also curious to know if you ever got into any sort of trouble with Joseph Stalin.
Yes, well, I was keen to reflect all the thinking and effort that went on in the Soviet Union in terms of World War II, because, I mean, in terms of the European war, it was all about the Soviet effort rather than, as I said, the American, the British, the Commonwealth sort of effort. Antonovich was a genius. He'd been a mathematician, a mathematical economist, and he had, before the war, been involved in doing consulting for some of these big Soviet collectivized factories, and particularly one that was producing plywood. They were producing plywood, actually, to build into some of these very basic early wartime Soviet planes and gliders, which were made out of plywood. And he had a problem. The factory came to him and said, "We've got this plywood. We're desperately short of materials. We want to make sure we're cutting up this plywood in the best way to make full use of the very limited resource here for the wartime effort." And Kantorovich went to work on the problem there and realized it was a mathematical optimization problem, maximizing certain features in terms of cutting outcomes from the scarce resource that he had. And we're now used to these optimization problems, but at the time knew nothing about them at all. And he worked out a mathematical formula, which we would now call linear programming, to maximize within a set of constraints how you do this. And the plywood factory put this into practice. It cut short all the very complicated things they were doing and gave them a much better outcome, and became known as linear programming. Although, because this was in the Soviet Union and there was a shroud of secrecy hung over so much of what they were doing, no news about this ever escaped the Soviet Union for another 10 years. And actually, we find that American economists and mathematicians working for the American government about 5, 6, 7, 8 years later reinvent linear programming and ways of sorting out these optimization problems. And it then goes into a whole big area of dynamic programming as well. Now, the book or the chapter on Kantorovich opens with Kantorovich out there doing something much more difficult in a way, and that is he is sent out onto the huge ice lake called Lake Lagoda outside Leningrad. Leningrad is in the grips of the worst city siege in history, where the Germans have surrounded it, cut off all the flow of food coming in and trying to starve it into submission. And it was just a completely terrible time. The only way that the Leningrad people could get food was in wintertime, when a lake on one side of them froze over, and Kantorovich's role at this time was to get out on that lake and carry out a whole series of measuring air temperatures, wind speeds, lake temperatures, thickness of ice, and a number of other features. And he built up some mathematical models that allowed him to simulate what would be an appropriately safe tonnage of trucks coming in convoy across that frozen lake. Initially, he miscalculated, and some of the trucks went right through the ice, and everybody drowned, and all the provisions were lost. But eventually, he was the key to making that lifeline work. But after he'd been evacuated out of Leningrad, he kept on working on his linear programming type of thinking, and he realized that while he had worked out how to make a factory more efficient with one product, he could really expand his model and his mathematical ideas to find a way to make a whole economy operate in a much more efficient way with a whole range of different goods. And he set up some very clever mathematical ways of doing this. And then he started to think about how you could actually solve these, because this quickly got so complicated that human calculation couldn't work it out. And he got into ideas about computing as well. Now, he put those ideas through to Gosplan, the big planning agency, and then others in the regime. And very quickly, a message came down from above, which said, you are thinking about dissident ways of bourgeois economics, and you must stop this immediately. You are putting in place a model that needs some sort of parameters to say what's important, what's not important. In a Western economy, those are called prices. There's markets and there's prices. In the Soviet economy, there were no markets. There was collectivization, and there were no prices because Karl Marx had written about the theory of labor surplus value, and all value should go back to labor. So very quickly, Kantorovich found himself being accused of westernized, dangerous bourgeois thinking, and he was told he had to drop all these ideas. Now, they were picked up after the war during Khrushchev's time and turned into much more sophisticated programming, but the ideas came from Kantorovich initially. He was quite a timid sort of character, and it's only because he was timid that he actually survived Stalin's regime, because Stalin had his own very strong views about economics and economists, and he'd killed quite a number of economists and locked up many, many others as well. So it was just a very difficult time. It was cut off from the West. Kantorovich's ideas couldn't go out to the West, and Kantorovich had done all these things without the advantage of learning about what was going on in Britain and the United States at that time as well.
Let's move to America. Vasily Leontief, who was he, and what was his mission that he had been assigned by America's Office of Strategic Services? And I'm interested to know about his input and output methodology. Obviously, I'm not an expert. I don't know the technicalities, but it would be great if you could explain what it was and how did it help America to kind of play Germany's economy.
Yes, well, Vasily Leontief was from a Russian family, and like so many people in the turn of the century and then into the 1920s and 30s, so many Europeans and Russians moved to the United States, particularly Jews, but others as well. And Central Europe lost, and the Soviet Union lost a lot of expertise in, of course, the Manhattan Project on the atom bomb, that's full of those sort of people, but economists as well. And Leontief was one of those. He ended up in Harvard in the US. And initially, he was taken, he was passed by the OSS, which was really the forerunner of the CIA, to advise them on the Russian economy or the Soviet economy, because the Americans, as they saw themselves coming into the war, were very worried about whether or not the Soviet economy was going to be strong enough to repel the Nazi invasion, or whether the Soviet Union was at risk of falling as well. And that was partly a military, but partly an economic question, because as we've said, the Soviet Union was very much a closed society at that stage. And so the OSS got mostly Leontief and several other really from the Russian diaspora economists in the United States to model the Soviet economy and put together what they could find from the very limited amount of Russian material about it. And broadly speaking, Leontief found an economy that was bigger and more complex and a little bit more sophisticated than the Americans had thought, whereas the Soviet system proved very incapable of helping a civilian economy to grow after the war with its lack of markets and prices. It was quite capable of putting together a military machine, a compulsory military machine, and that's what they were doing, and that was the message that came out from Leontief. But Leontief had also pioneered a new way of mapping an economy that we call input-output mapping. And that was to say, well, every economy produces a whole range of goods and services, but it also requires a lot of resources and inputs in order to do that. And so Leontief worked out a way of, for the American economy initially, mapping out just what was important from which sectors in order to produce what goods from which other sectors in a great big matrix, which he then had to simplify because it was far too complex for the very limited computing abilities around at that time. And he ran the American economy input-output model in simplified version on a huge electromechanical calculator, computer, if you like, at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Now, he then used that system more broadly, and he helped the Americans who had set up a big economic unit in London during the war. They were trying to work out how to not just work out where the growth points of an economy were to help it grow. They were trying to work out where the bottlenecks in the economy could be to help close it down. So they were interested in how they could use input-output analysis to close down an enemy economy. And this was all about the bombing strategy. So some economists like Charles Kindleberger and others were mapping out the Axis economy, particularly Germany plus its invaded territories, to work out which parts of that would you bomb in order to have most effect to close down their economic systems. And initially, input-output analysis said, well, identified ball bearing factories as a key part that was used in almost every part of moving machinery, but all came from only two factories, one in Cologne and one in neutral Sweden. And early on, the Americans and the British sent in their bombers to bomb those factories and close that down. Now, that did have some impact, but the Germans proved pretty flexible at finding alternative ways to reduce friction in a lot of this war material. The economists also moved on. They got a lot of very interesting information in quite innovative ways out of the German economy and decided that at various times they needed to bomb the factories producing fighter aircraft, later on to bomb the oil refineries because Germany had only a limited number of sources of oil, which was key for the economy. And as D-Day loomed, they worked out what they should be bombing to stop the Germans moving troops to the Western Front. And that was all about bombing railway lines particularly on bridges and particularly in sidings in rail clearing areas. And so that became a very important mechanism for working out where you would, how you would close down an economy. It wasn't quite as precise as I'm saying, but that was principally what they were trying to do. After the war, as Americans and Russians worked out that their potential next threats were one another in the Cold War, the Americans also plotted out the Soviet economy to try and work out where, how you would target nuclear warheads. And then they worked out, of course, that the Russians were doing the same thing to them. And so they worked out what looked most vulnerable in the American economy with big models there as well. And they were using, at this stage, early electronic computers to solve the most effective way of protecting or advancing those bottlenecks that they identified.
And now that we're talking about the United States, would be good to talk about John von Neumann and his contribution to developing the atomic bomb, and also, more importantly, his contribution to economics.
Yeah, well, von Neumann was a prodigy out of Budapest, he's Hungarian, and he came to the States in the 1930s and became a colleague of Einstein at Princeton University. He was brilliant, very right-wing, and he had been involved in the Manhattan Project to build the atom bomb, where he had developed the firing mechanisms for the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki. And he also was a colleague of Klaus Fuchs, who turned at the Manhattan Project, he turned out to be a Soviet spy and was feeding material back to the Soviet Union. And actually, in the Soviet Union after the war, Stalin tried to build on the information that he got from Fuchs and others out of the Manhattan Project to build a Soviet bomb. And he got Leonid Kantorovich involved in that. So we had von Neumann on one side, Kantorovich on the other side, both working on computing issues around these very complex bombs. But von Neumann had done a number of other things as well. He had played a very important role in advancing the really the first sophisticated electronic computer, the IAS computer, late in the war and then into the early Cold War. And he actually developed the what we now know as computing architecture, which has software, which has a hard core, and which has various other systems built up inside, and is still really the case. And in doing that, he designed this system, wrote up a very big manual, and insisted on publishing it publicly so that anywhere around the world, including the Soviets, could have access to this. It was really the world's first open source sort of computer manual of that sort, and became very influential in building second generation computers around the world after that. He also, together with another European migrant economist at Princeton, Oscar Morgenstern, had developed what was called game theory. Game theory said, well, a lot of economic theory where you have markets and players and markets is all very well, but what if you've got two players who are just looking at one another and working out how to take down the other operator and advance themselves? And this was game theory, because it was the same principle as he'd been used to playing in poker games, and we later saw in some of the chess game sort of technologies. But he worked out the mathematics behind all of this and what became some very famous solution systems to it afterwards. What do you do if you are trying to grow your economy, but somebody else is trying to do it at your expense? Donald Trump's sort of approach about a win-lose situation is in this sort of context. And it became very important during the Cold War, where it was pretty clear that the US and the Soviet Union were staring at one another across the Cold War Iron Curtain and working out what they could do to advance their own interests and hurt the others. Some of that was really just about bombing strategies. And I'm afraid von Neumann was, as I said, very strong right winger and very influential in the US. The military all adored him, and he did a lot of work for them. He was on the Atomic Energy Commission there as well. And he was advising on the US bomb. But his view, as quoted before Congress at a hearing there, was, we have, this was early 1950s, we have the bomb. The Soviet Union doesn't have the bomb, but they will in a couple of years. What are we waiting for? And this was the sort of the seeds of what became known as the MAD strategy, M-A-D, mutually assured destruction, where you say, well, we're going to build up our nuclear arsenal so much that the other side knows that if they attack us, they will be eventually wiped out. So they might be able to hurt us very, very badly, but we can eventually obliterate them. And for that reason, they won't use their arms. So we had this arms race of nuclear warheads building up. And a lot of the thinking behind it, developed later by the RAND Corporation in California, was around preemptive strategies so that you are so strong that nobody dares attack you. And in one sense, it was pretty horrific stuff. In another way, you could say, well, maybe for the last 40 years, we saw peace amongst the big powers, not amongst proxy smaller countries. And this was one of the reasons, because each country had a very big nuclear arsenal and therefore could not be attacked. And of course, coming up with the Ukraine war around, we're hearing from Putin and others some of this sort of talk going on again. But that was von Neumann, who was very, very influential in the American systems like that. Interestingly, he went on to advise on other nuclear tests in the States. He was at the Bikini Atoll tests in the Pacific. And like a number of them there, he was probably too close. And it looks like he got affected by radiation. And in the mid-1950s, he caught cancer and died. Sort of a victim of the things he'd been working on himself. But he played a very important role then going into the Cold War.
In general, how did the economic outlook and also the economic planning change after World War II?
Yes, well, I mean, of course, it was different in different countries. Places like Germany, parts of the Soviet Union, parts of China, and almost all Japan had suffered immense war damage from bombing. And they had to somehow put together economies that would rebuild for the country. And initially, there was terrible conditions, starvation and so on. Gradually, they got improved conditions and they rebuilt and they started to grow. And some of them, like Germany and Japan, actually started to grow very fast indeed. Now, you can't really separate this out from the Cold War, because at this stage, the Americans had decided that Stalin was not a war hero. He was more a threat to the future. And they were saw themselves as fighting the communist threat going through Europe, and also some extent in East Asia. So they were pouring money into Japan, pouring money into Germany, Marshall Plan and some of the other aid projects to help stimulate those economies. Other ones like Britain found themselves, as Britain had after World War One, which was they hadn't suffered physical damage, or much physical damage, they had suffered some, but their economies were in terrible shape. They had a lot of trouble moving from a wartime economy back to a civilian economy, and they had huge debt, mainly to the United States. So the US economy did very well out of World War One and out of World War II, both by building up large-scale factory production, which then went into producing automobiles and things like that, but also by lending money into allies, particularly Britain, and eventually taking over as security a lot of British investments, particularly in Latin America. So the US economy was actually growing very strongly, and they demobilized very quickly and poured, as I said, poured money into Japan and Germany for anti-communist purposes, British economy had a much tougher time, where it wasn't really physical damage from the war. It was a bunch of other disruptions and financial costs. And they also had quite a bit of social tensions as the soldiers came back from wartime. They were demobilized, and most of them wanted to see major change going on in the political system and in the economy. They booted out the war hero Winston Churchill. Labour came in and did a lot of nationalisation of some of the big economic operations. And it was a very complicated time. And that was really when Britain was forced into some tough decisions, which ended up with the Suez Crisis, where they really lost their standing as a world power at that point. And the US was clearly much stronger through that period as well. Soviets built up their own Comecon area of Eastern Europe, and they traded within that, but there was almost no trade went on between the Soviet bloc and the Americans. So in the Cold War, and quite, we hear a lot about decoupling today between the US and China, it's nothing like what it was in the Cold War. There simply was no trade between US and the Soviet Union until right through until the 1970s or 80s. So it was quite a different period. And countries like the Soviet Union that had been quite effective with a wartime command economy found that their central control, central planning, autocratic systems without markets were completely inadequate to the job of providing that whole range of sophisticated consumer products and services that a growing enriching population wanted to see. And that was ultimately what led to the decline of the whole Soviet Union bloc.
Before we come to the end of this interview, I'm curious to know if you have written any, if you're working any other projects.
Yes, Morteza, I have. I've recently published another book on economists during the Cold War, and that really picks up on the story that this one ends at, and looks at the, this was much more a battle of ideas. So during the Cold War, it was full of ideologies. You were either a capitalist using prices and markets, or you were a communist relying on central planning and Marxist-Leninist ideology. It became very difficult for economists to step out of those zones. And we had these big arguments about, would markets work best? Could a centrally planned economy actually operate efficiently? And so I go through a whole range of different countries, Poland, the United States, Germany, the British economy, and some of the Asian ones as well, and also another angle, which is the North-South divide. So an Argentinian economist in that who plays an important role in the whole area. Now, this comes together right at the end of the story in Chile, in Santiago, where in 1972, a socialist government was put in place. It was democratically elected, Salvador Allende. And he tried to actually physically build a central command center which could control the whole economy by advanced but centrally planned systems using modern computing, what was modern in those days, computing techniques, to send out messages to all the nationalized state-owned enterprises and have them produce more or less of whatever product and do it without prices. So it's the same old story from Kantorowicz and Ostrolani and others about, could you run an economy efficiently without markets and prices? And we'll never know the final outcome of that because there was a military coup and General Pinochet took over and he got his soldiers to blow up this particular center in Santiago. And they went from one extreme to a very much hands-off market-driven economy designed by what was called the Chicago Boys, which were a bunch of economists who trained under Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago in the 1960s. So quite a different story, but a pretty interesting one, and a pretty tense one as well, with all the argument, ideology, espionage, and so on that was going on through that period.
Mm. Thank you very much. I hope to be able to talk to you about that book as well. I'm really keen to read the book, and well, hopefully I can get in touch with you again in a couple of months to talk about that book on New Books Network. Professor Alan Ball, thank you very, very much for your time to talk with us about your book on New Books Network.
Thank you very much, Morteza. Thanks for the opportunity.